This is By the People, a series of Election 2004 programs produced by WILL Television and broadcast live Thursday nights on both WILL TV and AM 580, and rebroadcast Saturdays at 5 on the radio. This week's program features a reporter's roundtable discussion of Illinois races. Next Thursday at 7, a look at the 19th Congressional District race between Republican incumbent John Shimkus and Democratic challenger Tim Bagwell. That will be followed at 8 by the first in a series of presidential debates. You can keep up with all of our election-related programming by visiting our website, will.uiuc.edu.
Good evening, I'm John Paul, and welcome to the first By the People Election 2004 program on WILL-TV this election season. We'll be here every Thursday night until Election Day with programs to help you become a better informed Illinois voter. Tonight, we offer you a reporter roundtable to discuss some of the election year issues and happenings around the state of Illinois. We'll also be taking your phone calls tonight and answering your questions and listening to your comments about the political issues in Illinois. Joining me tonight with the reporter roundtable, William Wheelhouse, bureau chief and reporter for WUIS Radio in Springfield at the University of Illinois, Springfield, and the Capitol bureau chief for Illinois Public Radio. Kate Clements is here. She is the Capitol bureau chief and reporter in Springfield for the Champaign News Gazette. Bernard Schoenberg is here, a political reporter and columnist for the State Journal Register in Springfield, and Professor Charles Wheeler, a professor from the University of Illinois Springfield Public Affairs Reporting Curriculum. He is a former veteran statehouse reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times for more than 20 years. All four of our guests tonight are well-versed in state government issues and keen observers of the political process in Illinois, especially this important election year. Again, you can reach us tonight by heading to the telephone and calling WILL-TV at 217-333-3495. Thank you very much, ladies and lady and gentlemen. Thank you very much for being here. Let me start off with the happenings this week in Springfield and the shooting at the Capitol. How much, if any, has that shaken state government?
Well, I think it's been just a horrible thing. Many of us knew
Bill Wozniak.
I didn't know him well. He was a guard at the Capitol. You know, after 9/11, there were a lot of changes at the State House. They put up barriers at the entrances of the drives so that cars were stopped and searched. And occasionally, you know, one time there was a little scuffle where I think a pizza delivery man didn't want to be stopped and ended up being, you know, stopped by guards, and it was a little bit of a hassle. But things had eased off over the years. There were guards who are unarmed posted at the doors. You could walk in, you could show a photo ID badge that everybody who worked in the building regularly would be given. And Bill Wozniak, I just had a nice conversation with him a few weeks ago, got to know him a little bit, and here's a guy I'd seen for years on and off. And this, you know, apparently the person who's charged with going up to the State House using a shotgun, single shot, and killing Mr. Wozniak, obviously has had a past of mental problems, and it's just, it peels away, as has been said, another layer of, or brings a little more reality to the situation in a bad way. The governor now says, and Jesse White agrees, the Secretary of State, that they're going to put detectors, metal detectors at the entrances. It's going to be a hassle for folks. Maybe people think it's necessary. On the other hand, in this particular instance, everybody agrees it may not have made a difference, but they're going to go for arming the guards and just changing things.
Bill, you and Kate normally work at the Capitol every day, but were out covering a story that day. Both of you were.
Yeah,
but
we were about two blocks to the north when we got word that it happened and came back to the state capitol and could not get access into the building at that time. At that time, they weren't sure. They said that somebody thought the shooter was still in the building. But we were outside and roped off and for probably about an hour or so before they let us in. And echoing some of Bernie's comments, though, I think Many state capitals over the last few years have had problems. There was, in Nashville, I recall, a group of people against tax broke the windows in the governor's office. In California, I believe it was, somebody drove a heavy truck right up to the Capitol door. And I think the Illinois state capitol probably was a little lax in this area. I don't think much would have prevented what happened this time. It was just like the U.S. Capitol shooting, even metal detectors there. But certainly, the politicians are responding, and there probably will be increased security, more people carrying guns around at all times. And I think it will be a more secure place, but that doesn't always prevent anything. But I think we will see more security down the road.
Give me, if you can, Professor Wheeler, how do you characterize politics in the state of Illinois this year, this election year?
I think, although on the national scene there's a lot of activity, a lot of turmoil, we're sort of relatively insulated from what's going on at the presidential level, because both parties have pretty much agreed that Illinois is going to vote for the Democratic candidate John Kerry. And I think there's probably only a dozen or so states out of all 50 of them where there are truly competitive campaigns, the so-called battleground states, where the election will be decided. Illinois is going to be in the Democratic column probably no matter what. There'll be other states like Texas, obviously, will be in President Bush's column. So we're not seeing a lot of this activity that's going on, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars that are being spent on TV advertising, the appearance by the president and his vice president, his surrogates, Senator Kerry, Senator Edwards, and all the Democratic people. They just haven't come to Illinois the way they have to other states. So, as I say, it's pretty quiet for us. And then on our own state level, the race for the U.S. Senate, it's interesting, I guess you'd say, with the Republican candidate, Alan Keyes, trying every day to say something more outrageous than what he said the day before. But even there's no true contest. The polls, there was a poll in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I think it was Sunday or Monday of this week, speculating, or the story on the poll speculating, that Obama could win by a 3-1 margin. Senator Barack Obama, state senator who is a Democratic candidate.
Kate, do you feel left out here? Here you are, a political reporter. Illinois has been left out of the national scene when it comes to the Senate race and the presidential race.
I know. And also, really, a lot of the state legislative races are, you know, in our area, people are running unopposed. And so it's like I have one contested race, and then that's when I think it's going to be really exciting. But a lot of the other ones, like you said, you know, they're not spending money here. There's not a lot of TV ads. There's not a lot of races. People are, you know, really trying to decide between who they want to vote. And it's kind of
So what decided. Is there, what is there for a voter to get excited about in Illinois?
What is there? Well, there's always there's always county races and some legislative races. But it is true, since they're all single member districts in the House and Senate in Illinois, and since the new map was drawn just after the 2000 census, and usually very few districts are considered swing. Mostly they're going to favor the Republicans or favor the Democrats, and Congress is the same way. So it isn't. I got to be fair to the Republicans. There have been some polls in some places that show Bush getting somewhat close, within less than 10 points behind Kerry in Illinois. And so the Republican Party of Illinois, which is having its own problems, as the whole thing with Mr. Keyes shows, is saying, you know, the state is still in play. But I think to believe that, you have to also watch where the dollars are going. And of course, public TV is always fighting for dollars, but the commercial television is not getting the advertisements that battleground states are. So clearly the campaigns are not yet convinced on either side that they need to spend money here.
I don't think I've seen Keyes campaign commercials at this point, at least not in this particular
not Keyes. I was talking about the presidential race now. The presidential race, no money being spent. Obama is spending a lot, because I think he is trying very hard, after becoming somewhat of a national star of the Democratic Party when he gave the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention, to concentrate on Illinois. Now, he has been making some trips out of state, and he caught a little heat in one of the Chicago papers, Charlie's old paper, actually, for not really announcing, you know, when he's doing fundraisers or doing appearances in other states. So he's been doing some of that. But he has been very careful to travel a lot of small towns in Illinois, as Alan Keyes is doing on the Republican side. But Obama wants to make sure with his advertising here that he is running a real campaign, as if he had an opponent that wasn't 40 points behind him in a poll, just to show respect for the voters of Illinois. And, you know, let's not get him in the Senate before he gets elected to the Senate.
Well, a couple of things, though. Voters still, in Illinois can be excited about this presidential race, because nationwide it's a close race and people are going to be following it. So I don't think just how the turnout is, well, the turnout in Illinois or the vote total in Illinois matters electoral college-wise. I think there is still a big division out there in this nation and within this state. And so I think it is an exciting presidential race for a lot of people to follow. And I think certainly this is an interesting U.S. Senate race. You're going to have your first African-American candidate, regardless of who wins in Illinois. And you have a contrast in views between two candidates that is interesting.
Well, they're taking a dramatically different strategy from one another. You know, Obama's really focusing on issues like health care and education and the economy. And Keyes has really said, I'm going to focus on moral issues, and people need to care about those first, and everything else will kind of fall into place, and you should totally make your voting decision based on how you feel about abortion or gay marriage or, you know, the lack of separation between church and state. So, and they're not even debating the same issues. Yeah, they're going in totally different directions.
Well, and I find it interesting, of course, too, Obama is doing the strategy, you can do issues when you're far ahead, and so he's doing that. Keyes is mixing his moral arguments with pretty strong attacks on Obama. Of course, the most obvious is that Jesus, mixing the religion and the politics, that, you know, he told reporters in Chicago, and he's not shy about repeating things that other politicians wouldn't even consider saying, which is what makes this interesting, and which is probably why he's from Maryland instead of Illinois. But that's, I don't want to get into it. But, you know, when he said that Jesus would not vote for Barack Obama because of his position on abortion is one thing. You know, Illinois voters have generally elected pro-choice candidates. Illinois conservatives, and particularly mostly in the Republican Party, have wanted a strong voice for the conservative view on that, the pro-life view, and they found it in Alan Keyes, and we're going to see this year. This is a test of how strong that faction is when you get into a general election.
Let's take a call from a caller. Line 1, Villa Grove, you have a call or a question or comment for our guest tonight. Go ahead.
Yes, I do. I was wondering if any of the panel had read Robert Novak's rather shocking Sun-Times column of Monday, September 20th, in which he says a quick exit from Iraq is likely. It's pretty obvious Novak has at least one foot in the White House. He names names, says Connie Rice, Wolfowitz, Stephen Hadley, are all telling the president to pull out, and rumored that a large number of reserves, and especially from Illinois, are going to be taken after the election. I wonder if they'd read it, and what do they think the impact on Illinois will be?
Okay, thanks for your question. John?
I read Novak regularly, and a lot of times he does have the inside track. But I found that one to be not totally credible, for the simple reason that President Bush has committed so much of his prestige and so much of his image as a resolute man of action to staying the course in Iraq and repeating over and over, as he did before the United Nations, that we are not going to capitulate to the terrorists, we're not going to back down, we're going to stay there, by gosh, until democracy is in place. So I really don't see any kind of a dramatic pull out. I think that would hurt him politically more than it would help him. It might make some people who are opposed to the war feel better, but on the other hand, his core constituency, the folks who think the invasion of Iraq was correct and who are the folks who have the yellow ribbons on the back of their cars, they would look at that, I think, as almost being traitorous behavior, and it would seriously hurt his chances.
Yeah, well, of course, if you're talking about, did Novak say it was going to be before the election at all? Because if it's after the election, of course, we're talking about a president who, by our Constitution, now only has two terms.
Who really doesn't need to care.
Yeah.
I read it as that it was imminent.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, hard to tell at this point.
Yeah.
Let's take another caller. Line 2, Mawikwa, you have a question or comment for our guest tonight.
Yes, my question's regarding the Senate race between Keyes and Obama. And I think it was alluded to a little earlier that it sounds like the Keyes candidacy was part of a battle inside the party, and would like to hear if the reporters think that this helps or hurts the Republican Party in the long run.
Okay, thank you very much. Kate?
Well, my take is sort of that the conservative wing of the party has really been asking for this for a long time in a number of races, and here's sort of a unique opportunity where, you know, you... you didn't have a lot of people wanting the job who didn't, you know, they had a lot of people they approached to run, say they didn't want to do it. Now they say, here is an extremely conservative candidate. Here's the person that, you know, is very much to the right and very much in line with what that wing of the party has been asking for. Well, let's see how he does. And then that may be a factor in the debate when the party is looking at, you know, who's a good candidate to run for governor or something else. Say, you know, you had your chance and here's how he did. And, you know, he's not at all, you know, close in the polls.
Yeah, and despite the fact that Mr. Keyes thinks he'll do better and things will pick up, I'm not sure what's there. Clearly, it was perceived, I think, as a throwaway race because Barack Obama was so far ahead, nobody was going to beat him. Credible candidates, particularly a couple legislators like Steve Rauschenberger and DuPage County Chairman.
Robert Schiller.
DuPage County Board. Republican Chairman. Kirk Dillard, state senator,
okay.
Were both considered as possible candidates. Both turned it down for different reasons.
Ron Gidwitz, who had been at one point chair of the State Board of Education.
That's right. You had people Chicago who could have made a run, gotten their names known, maybe gotten in position to run for something in 2006. I think they were scared, for varying reasons, of being beat so badly that they would look not like a winner next time around. But I think bringing Keyes in, it has made regular Republicans, and where we live in Springfield, a lot of them just roll their eyes still. How could the party do this? And I think it is damaging to the extent that the party just completely threw in the towel on this election.
What do you think it's done for Illinois Republicans who have lined up in the past behind the likes of Jim Edgar and Jim Thompson?
Well, I think I agree with what Kate said in that there historically the Republican Party has had this kind of working accommodation between people who were ideologically very conservative and other people who were pragmatists and who were Republicans probably by an accident of birth. Former Governor George Ryan was from Kankakee. Had George Ryan been brought up in Bridgeport, the Chicago neighborhood where Mayor Daley was, George Ryan would have been a Democrat. He was a pragmatic politician. Ideology was not his main concern. The Republicans who have won statewide, with the exception of Peter Fitzgerald, all were pragmatic moderates. Illinois is basically a middle-of-the-road state. So the moderates, who've been getting all this pressure from the true believers, said, okay, here's a chance. We'll run a true believer, and you show us what he can do. And I think there was also, on the part of some of the people who brought Keyes into the race, the hope that in certain legislative districts, and there are some contested races, a handful, but there are some, they felt that a fiery right-wing articulate candidate at the top of the ticket would energize like-minded voters in those districts to go out and vote for Keyes and then vote for the Republican legislative candidate as well. Now, whether or not that'll work remains to be seen.
Does the selection of Keyes at all help the Republican Party or hurt the Republican Party going into the gubernatorial campaign for 2006?
Well, I don't think it builds any training ground for anybody. It's an out-of-state candidate that won't be here 2 years from now if he loses. And
I don't think he'll keep his apartment in Calumet.
I don't think he'll keep his apartment. I think the Republican Party right now is split between two strong elements, the vocal element, the conservative element, and the establishment Republicans. And they tried to run Jim Durkin against Dick Durbin last time around, got killed, but there was a name they were trying to groom. They didn't try to groom anybody this time around, it looked like, after things blew up in their face. I guarantee we'd be having a different conversation here if Mike Ditka had run, and Mike Ditka almost holds the same stances as Alan Keyes on a lot of issues, but he'd peel off the ethnic Democrats with no problem. But I bet he is the same on gay marriage, abortion, and everything else. And we'd be having a much different conversation because it'd be a much closer election.
Certainly would.
The question is really, can the Republican Party reunify? And a lot of times they run candidates from the different factions in a primary, and then they say, okay, we're going to get together behind the winner and move on. And this is a general election candidate that a lot of members of the party have said, I can't vote for this guy, you know, and prominent members of the party. So, you know, it's just a matter of that prevents any kind of even appearance of unity.
I think the Republicans have been going in this direction, this factionalism, a little bit since Pat O'Malley in, 2000? But just in the last gubernatorial election, we had a conservative candidate who lost in the primary, and then he never really said he was for Jim Ryan, as I recall, who was the candidate that lost to Rod Blagojevich. I will also say that despite the tremendous disarray that is now in the Republican Party, if you look back a few years to 1986 when the Democratic Party was in tremendous disarray after a couple of followers of Lyndon LaRouche ended up on the statewide ballot because people didn't do their homework and get the palm cards with all the names on, and nice names beat kind of goofy names of the regular politicians.
Well, no, they weren't goofy, they were ethnic.
Ethnic, excuse me, Mr. Sangmeister. But that party, you know, now controls the House, the Senate, and all but one constitutional office in the state of Illinois, so things can change rather radically over time.
Well, the Democrats fell apart 10 years ago this election. I mean, totally lost it. It was a tidal shift, and now they're back in control.
Well, as a matter of fact, people might argue that the Democrats just this past spring on the legislative level evinced the same kind of tearing apart. The Democrats, as Bernie said, had control of the House and the Senate. They have the governor, and they weren't able to get their act together enough to pass a budget on time. And as a result, Republican votes were needed to pass the budget, and the final shape of the budget reflected Republican priorities that would not have been in there had the Democrats acted unilaterally as they had the votes, the majorities in the chambers to do. And to me, one of the most interesting things about this whole budget debacle from the Democratic point of view is that the governor signed more than 50
memorandums
of understanding, which in essence the legislative leaders, particularly House Speaker Michael Madigan, a fellow Democrat, also from Chicago, said, "You maybe have told me this orally. I don't trust you. You put it in writing and sign on the dotted line because your word is no good with me." And that's unprecedented. I shouldn't say unprecedented. I wasn't here in the 1800s, but you know, from the time what I would call modern Illinois government, which began with Richard Ogilvie, with annual sessions, income tax, the rest of it, in all of that period of time, there has never been a situation where the governor's word was so suspect that he had to actually put in writing some of the promises he made. I mean, for all the difficulties George Ryan had, and he's under indictment for racketeering and very serious offenses, public corruption, there was never any question among legislators that when George Ryan said yes, that he would go back on his word or that he would conveniently forget what he had promised. And I think a lot of the legislators have this problem
George
with Governor Blagojevich.
Angel, of course.
Oh, no. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, though, that for all of the public charges leveled against George Ryan, no one has ever said that we needed him to sign memorands of understanding to make sure he kept his word to us, the legislature.
Right. Let's move on to another caller who's been patiently waiting on line 3. You're still there in Champaign. You have a question or comment.
Did Blair Hull get eliminated in the primary?
Blair Hull got eliminated in the primary. This was rather historic this year, really, because Peter Fitzgerald, the Republican in the U.S. Senate for one term, is not running for a second term, we had a wide open field this time. And so you had, 7 or 8 candidates in each party. And Blair Hull spent, in a primary race, $30 million. Now, Rod Blagojevich broke records running for governor by over a year and a half, spending like, I think, $24 million. So Blair Hull spent more than any politician in the history of the state of Illinois has spent, and only in a primary. And what was amazing was he, with all of his advertising, he got rather popular and people knew him, and he was leading in the polls over people including Barack Obama and Dan Hynes, the state comptroller, who has a well-known name. But it was that wide but narrow support, because all it took was one little allegation about that came out in his divorce file, that there was an allegation that he had hit his wife in the knee or in the leg during a fight. And because voters didn't know who this guy was, all this publicity just toppled his house of cards. And, you know, Obama did end up emerging and winning with more than 50% of all votes in a field of 7 or 8 candidates.
So it was kind a real free-for-all in the primary.
It was kind of amazing. And, you know, now that's where the TV stations made a lot of money, with Mr.
Last
Hall.
Spring. Let's take another call on line 1 from Sangamon County. You have a question or comment tonight.
Hey, I appreciate the show. I appreciate you taking my call. Be interested in the panel's input to what to me now is just unquestionably clear evidence and perhaps even very strong proof that there very well may be media bias, especially considering the CBS fiasco. I'd be interested in your thoughts about it, and really, can big traditional news, I'll say CBS, ABC, NBC, can they survive? Can they have any credibility?
Okay, thank you for your comment. Of course, you guys are local reporters. That's a question more on a national level.
Well, one thing that really sort of always frustrates me is when people say, the media this or the media that. I mean, I think you have to look at each reporter's work individually, even within a single newspaper or a television station, and say, do you find this person credible? Do you think that their work is fair and balanced? And, you know, decide who you trust and who you don't. I just don't like it when people say, oh, the media is
painting with a wide brush.
Right. Just a generalization.
And you might argue, those people who would look at CBS and say this shows their bias, my guess is those same people would look at Fox News and say these folks are right on. Although there are a lot of folks who look at Fox News as being slanted a particular way.
I don't think there's anybody in the news business. I think there are some people who certainly have their own views and some people who work for outlets that allow them to express those views more than perhaps other outlets would, based on whatever they think a story is and what their editors think a story is. I don't think anybody goes out to do a story that's proven incorrect. I don't think Dan Rather, he knows through the years in the business, and I'm not saying anything about if I like him or not, but I don't think he wanted this to happen. I don't think he wanted to go to press with a story that would be proven wrong, because you know that credibility is what you're selling, and if you don't have credibility, it hurts you personally a lot.
Right.
There's a lot of pressure in the news business in general to get the scoop, to get the story first, and that would seem to me to have been a part of what happened here, but I'm just an outsider reading as it is. But the whole idea that there's a, you know, I don't think there's a conspiracy. I think it's individual decisions made by individual people about what they report, and I don't think people try to be wrong.
I think most media managers are too dumb to create a conspiracy.
sort of play devil's advocate, one might argue that CBS News and Dan Rather went with what they thought was a very good story. They did not investigate it well enough to have nailed down the fact that some of the documentation was spurious. One might apply the same analogy to the president, who put forward certain reasons why we had to invade Iraq and topple Saddam Hussein. And now, many months after that invasion, some of those reasons prove not to be true. We still have yet to find the weapons of mass destruction that were one of the... I don't think the president was lying when he said there's weapons of mass destruction. He honestly believed it based on what turned out to be faulty information. You make your judgment based on what you do. You do your best to investigate it. If you're a reporter and you're checking out a tip about something, you do your best to nail it down, but then ultimately have to make a judgment call.
You don't see an overall conspiracy, though, the way some people label the media as being...
No, I think a lot of people who are media critics and label the media as being biased look only at the media that doesn't agree with them. I mean, is Robert Novak biased? Would somebody say that Bob Novak is part of the liberal conspiracy?
Yeah, you know, as you peruse the radio dial these days, I mean, since Rush Limbaugh started this in the early Clinton years, conservative talk dominates a lot of airwaves on a lot of stations all day long. And yet there's still this talk about, you know, the liberal media in general. And the caller talked about, you know, can big media survive? Well, I'm not sure if everything stays the same with the age of internet and everything else, but, you know, are you going to let somebody running a web log, or, you know, are you going to let the Drudge Report be the media that you believe? I mean, it may morph into different ways, but, you know, still a place needs resources and good reporters to get it accurate, to be trusted. And I think the big companies probably will survive, and we'll see if it changes form.
We're seeing the first major election here after redistricting in 2000. And in many degrees, in many, many cases, I think people look at the congressional districts in Illinois and to some degree the state legislative districts and say those lines were drawn so that congressmen could pick their own voters rather than voters picking their congressmen. At least that's the argument by some political scientists. Is there a reason to change the way Illinois gives its electoral votes in the president's race? Should it be a winner-take-all the way it is now, or should there be, in the 15th district, if the Republicans vote for Bush, he gets one electoral vote for the state of Illinois, and if another district votes that way? Is there a reason to change that?
Well, I think that would change the whole way the redistricting is decided. I mean, the districts were decided, especially this last time around, for the congressional level, pretty calmly. I mean, they sort of came out with a map and said, here's what we'd like you to pass, and they did it, and it was...
Well, because both parties agreed.
Right, because both parties agreed and protected themselves.
Benny Hassert for the Republicans and Congressman Bill Lipinski from Chicago for the Democrats basically produced the map guaranteed to re-elect all the incumbents except for poor David Phelps from Southern Illinois, who wound up mapped into a district that basically... it takes in the territory right here in Champaign County, Tim Johnson's congressional district.
And for the most part, you believe the incumbent congressmen in Illinois are bound to go back to Congress at this point?
That is...
Or is anybody in jeopardy?
Well, there is talk that Phil Crane, who's been a congressman on the North Shore, North Suburbs of Chicago for, is it 30 years already? It's about that. Is being challenged by an energetic Democrat named Melissa Bean, and you know, he has, even Ray LaHood, a Central Illinois congressman from Peoria, said at one point, or was quoted in a Washington publication, saying, you know, maybe he hasn't paid enough attention to his district, and LaHood later apologized for that. But Crane has said, I'm really paying attention to my district now, and he's back there a lot. So that one seems to be potentially in play, but
you don't see a change in the way the electoral system works.
The electoral
that would require an amendment to the U.S. Constitution,
yeah.
I believe,
sure.
I don't see much support for that. There was more talk about doing away with the Electoral College and going to the popular vote after the last election, when by the popular vote, Al Gore had more votes, total votes, from the electorate than did George Bush, but when you counted up the electoral votes per state, George Bush prevailed.
Something rings a bell about maybe some states are able to do this in some way, but I'm not sure. If it ever came to that, however legally it would happen, it would certainly create more interest in presidential races, because like in Sangamon County, where there's a concentration of Republicans, boy, they're going to get out because they're going to want their votes to count for Bush. And there is, you know, as Charlie said earlier, less of an impetus now, as it looks like this is a Kerry state.
Let me go back to another caller. Line 2, you've been patiently waiting in Urbana. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Thank you. I'd like to get back to the issue of credibility, if we might. During the Republican convention that I was watching on your network, in response to speeches made by Zell Miller and Dick Cheney, Mark Shields commented that some of the statements that Miller and Cheney attributed to John Kerry weren't true, and in fact he called them lies. And then when Jim Lehrer turned to David Brooks to comment on that, David Brooks said, well, yeah, well, they were lies, but you know, they're politicians, and you know, Harry Truman also extended without the truth a bit. So what took place there was absolutely shocking to me, because not only did the politicians come out with false statements, we'll call them lies, but then it was being condoned by the press. And to me, I don't know who to believe anymore.
Do you think,
regardless of the amount of money they're spending trying to get me to believe them?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think at the beginning of the caller's question, there was a key word used. He said they're commentators. Different media outlets hire people who are either political scientists or reporters or columnists or whatever, sometimes from academia. And, you know, they can twist it as they wish, and there is a lot of choice on the viewing dial. I do think that as a reporter, we see a lot of we get used a lot, or people try to use us a lot. And I think, you know, you try as a reporter always not to be used, not to just forward information that gives the wrong impression, that has the spin. I don't mind giving somebody spin, but if I know that spin is not true, I'm going to work awfully hard to find out why and present the facts in the publication I work for. And I think all of us would be the same, or to teach our students the same, to say you want accurate truth out there. And I think even as reporters, we see so much spin, and voters must be very frustrated, as this caller is, by all the spin that comes from both sides. I get at my work about 10 or 15 or 20 emails a day for months from the Bush campaign saying how John Kerry is a bad guy in almost everything he says. They have different congressmen and people saying it. Kerry's campaign, for some reason, they don't have my email addresses enough. You get very little of stuff like that. I think it, however, is interesting. It characterizes things. You know, Jay Leno on The Tonight Show makes fun of John Kerry for being a flip-flopper. That's exactly what almost every one of these emails tries to get across, and they have positioned John Kerry that way. And there's a lot of this spin, and people have to see through it and make up their own mind, but it's hard to do.
Very hard to do.
Part of it is that modern elections are not so much contests of ideas as they are marketing. There are very clever, talented people in both candidates' camps who spend all their time trying to figure out, how can I convince you, the viewer at home, to vote for my candidate? What buttons do I have to push? It's much as though they were selling cornflakes or, you know, beer. And you have to listen to everything that's said with a grain of salt. You have to listen to both sides or all the sides and form your own judgments, because people can come to different conclusions off the same set of facts depending on their perspective, on their values, on what they think is important, their priorities. But the important thing is to realize that none of this is being presented as being the straightforward – it is presenting as – being presented as though it were the straightforward truth, but it's not. It's all designed to sell the product.
Let me get to another caller, if I can, on line 3 in Mount Zion. You have a question or comment for the guest tonight.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, it seemed like the Democrats had a kinder, gentler convention this time around. First off, do you think they made a mistake by going too positive with their convention? And also, the Republicans, you always hear about Karl Rove. Who's the Democrats' Karl Rove?
Okay, thanks for your comment.
In the first part of the question, I think both try to go as positive as possible in that stage thing we call a political convention. And maybe this time around the Democrats were more positive and the Republicans had the opportunity to take a few more shots. But all in all, very, very few people of the electorate actually paid attention as far as watching all of the speeches, so everybody was trying for that quick quote that would make the news. As far as the second half of the question, I don't have an answer there.
And maybe there isn't one. Maybe that's part of Senator Kerry's problem.
Well, I think it's been my impression, it was just so happened that I covered the Democratic convention and another person from our organization covered the Republican. I think Kerry made an effort not to let people say too much bad about the president, because that's been the way he's going. He's going to be kinder, gentler. I'm not sure that works well. I do think negative works some. Now, Ted Kennedy gave a speech that was negative on the president to some extent, and Al Sharpton gave a speech that was quite negative. But again, if you weren't watching cable, I don't think you saw this. I'm not sure of the timing, because you know when you're there, you're not sure. Yeah, and Barack Obama in his keynote was only fleetingly mentioned Bush, didn't even name the president in any of that speech. Whereas on the other side, the keynoter for the Republicans was Zell Miller, who it was nothing but attacks on Kerry. I think if you look at the polls, now all of us in the political world or watching it always say it's a terrible thing they're doing negative campaigns, and very often the negative campaigner wins, or certainly it's the kind of thing that they say moves poll numbers. Mm-hmm. And I think the Republicans have been more sharp. As far as who is the Karl Rove of the Democrat side? Well, I think John Kerry just hired Carville and some of the other, and Lockhart, some of the other people from the Clinton team to sharpen his message. And I personally think that's probably going to help close the gap, because I think Kerry has been nice out there, and the polls keep saying people don't know what he stands for, and he needs to sharpen the message, or George Bush is going to carry it away because he's protecting America.
Let me come back to a couple of Illinois issues. To what degree does what's happening in the U.S. Senate race in Illinois affect anything else on the ballot? I mean, is there any influence of the Keyes conservatism campaign on any other candidates at the local level? Or do you see anything, I mean, are there coattails, so to speak, for Obama?
I think coattails are more or less a thing of the past, and especially since straight party voting was eliminated in the last decade, that really, unless it's just going to be some major political realignment, some abnormality in the way that just things are going that year, that by and large it's an electoral system that favors the incumbents more than anything. And I don't think really that many people down the ticket who are closer probably to the county board or school board election than they are to the U.S. Senate race are going to be affected by what's going on in that U.S. Senate race or that primary.
There was talk, though, that Keyes may bring more conservative voters in some areas of the state.
Yeah, that was one of the rationales that was put forward for why Keyes was chosen as the candidate. But on the other hand, the incumbent Democrats in those districts are pretty conservative people, too. Having watched the legislature for more than 20 years, Democrats from southern Illinois, by and large, are more conservative than Republicans from Chicago's suburbs, particularly suburban Cook County. And in fact, there are a couple of Republican candidates in Cook County and the suburbs incumbents who are concerned that their chances of reelection are going to be somewhat undermined because moderate Republicans are going to be turned off by Alan Keyes and not show up. Because those are districts that tend to be very socially moderate, if not liberal, fiscally conservative, and the representatives kind of fit the district well. And someone with a message like Alan Keyes is totally out of sync with the majority of the voters in the district.
Let me get to another caller who's been patiently waiting on line 6 in Shelbyville. Go ahead. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I live here in the 19th district, and I was wanting to know why we're not hearing much about the congressional races up and down the state, and has the Democrats wrote off the southern congressional district?
Okay, thank you for your question or comment. That 19th district is John Shimkus district,
right,
who is a Collinsville resident, and he's running against Tim Bagwell from Olney. Indeed, many of us in this part of the state don't see a lot of coverage of that race. Is there a write-off by Democrats in that part?
Well, I wouldn't call it a Tier 1 race right now, and I'll say that because John Shimkus first got elected when Dick Durbin finally got elected to the U.S. Senate. I think that's 96. So you're talking about an incumbent seeking his fifth term. And he works the district hard. He's a lot of places. Tim Bagwell is not an office holder at this point. He is a Democrat who is in private business and just decided to run. He has been to Springfield for a press conference or two. He was at the state fair.
He's coming next week to Springfield.
Well, there you go. There are certain dynamics that present themselves when you have a real challenge to an incumbent and you can tell something is building. Either the incumbent is in a certain amount of trouble over some issues, or the challenger is just extremely energetic and has a base of support that seems to grow. We haven't seen that yet in the 19th. There will be obligatory coverage of the race as it goes. But that is one of those districts where if a Democrat was going to win in any circumstance, it would be difficult. And you've got a Republican incumbent who I don't think is in significant trouble.
Simply because of the way the district is drawn.
Well, most of the voters are going to be Republican regardless unless something odd is going on.
And just geographically, the population center is on the western side of the district in the Metro East area, portions of Springfield, which is a more populous part of the state than the southeastern portion of the district.
All right, let's move along to line 4. A caller on line 4. You have a question or comment for the guest tonight.
Yes, I have a question. And hopefully it's not too imprudent in the scope of the panel's ability to answer. But my question is, what in the panel's opinions are the pivotal issues other than the war and economy and how they impact Illinois compared to the rest of the country?
Okay, thanks for your question, and we were going to get to that later on along my list. What do you view as the top issues in the state of Illinois, and how do they fit in the national picture?
Well, I think what he mentioned, the war and the economy in the national race, are the things that are going to be on people's mind. And one that a lot of people have to look at is that the state of Illinois has lost a lot of jobs over the years, and it's doubtful those jobs are coming back, industrial manufacturing jobs. Some have left for southern states, but more have left for other countries. And that is a problem everyone is wrestling with, and nobody has presented a real solution to. Everybody has ideas for tax breaks and let's not help companies that are sending jobs overseas, but it's quite tough. And I think that will affect the national race, their view, and probably to some degree the U.S. Senate race. And then when it comes down to the state Senate race or your state representative race, a lot of times those are more parochial and local issues than those types of things.
Kate, I know there's a lot of talk at the national level about national security and the war. Do you detect that among the races you watch and the politicians you watch in central Illinois? I mean, is national security and is the Iraq war weighing heavy?
I think mostly what I've been covering, based on what's going on at the Capitol is the state budget crisis and how that affects the local districts. Higher education funding has been a huge issue for us, and you know, the governor has really sort of targeted higher education funding, and you know, healthcare and K-12 education, some things like that.
But it's a money
issue.
Yes,
I mean, people do have strong feelings about the war, but I don't think that that's something that translates so much farther down the ticket.
I think the war becomes the issue when in Congress or other national offices, and the security question becomes one of how do we get enough money from Homeland Security to protect the state capitol or protect our county courthouse, those kinds of nuts and bolts thing. But as far as the general policy of where the country should go in the war situation, I think you're talking Congress, Senate, and presidential race.
We do have a local candidate that's the Socialist Equality Party candidate in the 103rd district race is trying to sort of make that an issue, and his platform, you know, a big part of it is the war, but I just don't think that that's going to, you know, translate into something for the voters that, you know, that's not their main concern when they're voting for their state representative.
It's money and family issues then. Okay, let's go to line two, Tuscola. You have a question or comment?
I have a comment, please.
Okay.
I just listened to an awful lot of the speeches and the comments of different parties and different people. We have Iraq, that's a fact. We know how it started, why. Everybody's opinion is why. But I don't understand why. Instead of we have everybody hollering, well, I want this and I want that, I don't understand why they can't get together and decide to be Americans. And what's good for America instead of, well, what's good for me? What's going to go on my thing?
You still think there is a what's in it for me from the politician standpoint?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Thank you for your comment. Let me move to line three, Bloomington, Illinois. You have a question or comment for us tonight.
I have a question, and I don't have a preconceived answer. The movement of industry from Illinois, as other parts of the United States overseas, has great effects upon employment. Many of these jobs could be, I'm sure, handled automatically with machines and such, and maybe they should go overseas. But we've converted to the import of goods that normally moved within a state or across state lines that were not affecting our balance of payments. The long term of moving such vast amounts of industry, not only from the state of Illinois but others, I wonder, what are your opinions as to how we overcome this and how do we remain financially viable over the long term?
Okay. Thank you for your call from Bloomington tonight to WILL-TV. What about that, importing our jobs or exporting our jobs in this case?
I'm not an economist. I've actually worked in Bloomington at the time at the Mitsubishi plant located there 20 years ago or 15 years ago, and now you see, and they built up to whatever it is, 3,000 employees, and now they're laying off more than 1,000, and it's very unfortunate that the ebb and flow happens. I think the economy is a growing and changing thing. It is for our politicians that we elect to figure out how we deal with the rest of the world and if tariffs should be there or if it should all be free trade. I think there's an ongoing battle, and you hear the candidates talking about it, but if you remember in the 90s, there was a boom in computer services now, and then there was the bust in that and all the stocks that were bought. So it's an ebb and flow, and unfortunately, that creates an uncertainty. It's not like it was 40 years ago. You go to work in the factory when you're 18, you come out when you're 65, you got a good pension, and you've been there every day for 8 hours, and you've enjoyed your weekends. Unionism is down. Maybe that will pick up again with the uncertainty. I don't know that if anyone at this table had a good answer, then we should be running for something, I think.
But I think there's some forces at work, though, almost contradictory forces. The caller mentioned the fact that if machines can do the work more cheaply, then maybe we should use machines. But in fact, the jobs that are being exported aren't to be done by machines in these other countries. They're to be done by workers who will work at a wage, a fraction of what an American worker owns. This country has a very high standard of living. Our work is rewarded with high wages. A lot of people are willing to do that same work for much less to raise their standard of living. And because the American consumer wants to buy goods very cheaply, there's an incentive for companies to go where they can have labor costs as low as possible. And because there's also the expectation that if I invested in a company, I want to get a good return on my investment, there's an incentive for the leaders of that company to try and maximize their profits. And so in a sense, the quest for higher profits and cheaper costs is one of the factors driving manufacturing overseas and offshore, and it's in response to what the American public wants in their goods. And I see this as kind of a tension, and I'm like Bernie, I don't have any solutions. If I had solutions, I suppose I'd be running for something too.
And we might vote for you.
Let me pull back a little bit to Illinois here. As you look at the election, you've got your crystal ball out. Any surprises in Illinois anywhere? If you were a betting person going into the race, is there an underdog? Is there an upset in the making somewhere?
I just think of, we didn't discuss it earlier with the congressional districts, the 17th congressional district, Lane Evans. It's a very Democratic district. Andrea Lane Zinga is trying to make an issue out of the fact that Lane Evans has Parkinson's disease and he's had it for several years. And I don't think it's catching traction, but you never know. It depends if there's any significant advertising there. Still looks like a safe district for Lane Evans. I don't see any big surprises. Unless, you know, as we mentioned, Congressman Crane is in trouble, as some believe.
Bill, any surprises anywhere that from your crystal
ball? Not really. I think legislative control will likely stay in the same hands that it is in both chambers, the Democrats. I don't really think Governor Rob Blagojevich so far is going to have much impact on helping or hurting candidates out there. But you never know. I do think Alan Keyes is going to get a higher percentage of the vote than people are saying right now, though.
Well, perhaps that's the surprise. Kate, do you see any surprises, anything shocking the day after the election?
I don't know. I mean, there are a couple of hotly contested legislative races, but I think in the end, you know, if they're switching parties and specific seats, over, you know, the end result is still kind of the same in terms of control.
The control of the Senate, control of the House at the state legislature is not going to change much, is what you say.
Right.
No.
You don't think that'll change much?
No.
Charlie, do you see any surprises?
Pick up a seat or two, but certainly not enough to overcome the advantage. I mean, the Democrats drew the map, and the map was drawn to elect Democratic majorities for a decade, and I don't see that failing. One race we haven't talked about that will be interesting is a race for the 5th District Supreme Court spot. There's a lot of money going to be invested. It's already been invested in that race. It pits a Republican circuit court judge against a Democratic appellate court justice in a district that takes in about the bottom third of the state. And the issue there is over medical malpractice and whether or not the state should put caps on the kind of awards that are given for non-economic damages, the so-called pain and suffering. Business community is very strongly behind the Republican. The folks who favor unlimited awards, mainly trial lawyers whose fees are contingent upon the size of those awards, are strongly behind the Democrat. So that's kind of an interesting race.
John Shimkus told me last week medical malpractice is the most common word he hears among voters in his district.
In his district.
Not the war, not the economy.
Interesting. In his part of the state where it has received a lot more publicity close to the border and where they're in the rural areas where there is a shortage. One other just quick note is these judicial races, while they still won't get a lot of attention, they're getting a lot of attention financially, and a lot of people are throwing money into that.
So visibility-wise.
So movers and shakers are really concerned about what's going on.
We have two callers who've been patiently waiting. Let's see if we can get to them. Line one in Champaign, you have a question.
Yeah, well, I had a comment. Earlier you were talking about credibility in the media, and I've been watching the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. They give a factual summary of something, and they have people discuss with different points of view, which I think is really helpful. But one of the things that was on there, they talked about an organization, factcheck.org. So that I went there, I looked at their pages, it's online, and they had a special report that said that candidates can lie. There's no law that says people cannot lie when they're doing election advertising, which was kind of shocking, but apparently that's the case. Another thing that's good about that website is they actually give sources. So when they talk about ads or statements made by the candidates, they actually say, they look up the information. So if people really want to know what's going on, I think they should search online, look at factcheck.org, and get straight information themselves that they can trust.
And there are some media, thank you for your call, there are a few media outlets that actually do fact check campaign commercials and the like. Let me get to one other caller. Line two in Taylorville, go ahead.
Well, I have a question. My question is, the governor that we have now, Governor Blagojevich, has also made a lot of promises during his campaign. And my question is, with all those campaign promises that he gave out to everyone and was unable to fulfill those. Will that hurt him in two more years when he comes up for re-election?
Okay, just a few minutes left, so.
Okay, Governor Blagojevich has, I think, been a very controversial governor, and yet he has also raised more money as a midterm governor than anyone in history in that office. He's got $10 million in his campaign fund already. He has, I think, caused a lot of people distress because he said he would do certain things, close facilities or keep facilities open, and then seemingly wanting the other thing, and the legislature has had to rein him in on some of it. Plus, he attacks people like legislators, and he tends to find the enemy of the day for his press availabilities. So I think the $10 million is a big deal to overcome, but I think there could be a significant challenge mounted, considering the state's continuing budget problems that could cause operational problems.
Let me ask real quickly, just brief answers. Who's the Republican candidate for governor in 2 years?
I'll take a pass on that, but I'll throw out one name that I heard people talking about, Doug Whitley, who is president of the State Chamber of Commerce, who would be a business person and not a typical politician.
Okay. Kate?
I think it's somebody that's maybe not one of the names that's being tossed around right now. And I don't know who.
A surprise. Who did?
I don't know who, but I don't think it's going to be Judy Bartopinga. I think it's going to be someone that comes out of the woodwork later.
I can't give a name. It won't be anybody with the establishment. It'll probably be with somebody with money.
And Bernie?
There's been a rumor about Speaker Denny Hastert of the U.S. House, but his people say that's probably not going to happen. It's wishful thinking. And Doug Whitley would be an interesting candidate.
Well, and look at Rod Blagojevich. Who would have thought he'd been governor? Tell the story about when you ran into...
We need to wrap things up. And our thanks to all of you tonight, to Kate Clements from the News Gazette, to Bernie Schoenberg from the State Journal Register in Springfield, Bill Wheelhouse from the radio station WUIS in Springfield, and Professor Charles Wheeler from the University of Illinois at Springfield. Next week on WILL's By the People, we'll take a look at that 19th congressional race with John Shimkus and Tim Bagwell. For now, that's it here on WILL-TV. We hope you have a great evening.
You've been listening to a rebroadcast of a Reporters' Roundtable discussion of Illinois races this election year, part of WILL's By the People initiative, a series of Election 2004 programs produced by WILL Television and broadcast live Thursday nights on both WILL-TV and AM 580, and rebroadcast Saturdays at 5 on the radio. Next Thursday at 7, it's a look at the 19th congressional district race between Republican incumbent John Shimkus and Democratic challenger Tim Bagwell. That'll be followed at 8 by the first in a series of presidential debates. Next week on Focus 580, here on the radio, it's your chance to call in and ask questions of candidates for the 103rd Statehouse seat. Tuesday morning at 10, Republican Deborah Frank Finan. Thursday morning at 10, Democratic incumbent Naomi Jacobson, and Friday morning at 10, Socialist Equality Party candidate Tom Mackeman. You can keep up with all of our election-related programming by visiting our website, will.uiuc.edu.